You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, who should be setting more policy, the federal government or state governments? We troubleshoot America's ongoing experiment with federalism. Now, President Trump was released from the Walter Reed Army Medical Center yesterday after being hospitalized for COVID-19. Throughout his hospitalization, there was confusion about just how severe the president's condition was, the kind of treatment he was receiving, and why his medical team suddenly deemed it necessary to transport the president to the hospital last week. So how much does the public have the right to know about the health of an American president? And when the president has a disease that has killed 210,000 Americans, how much privacy is he or she allowed? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What should the public be entitled to, if anything, when it comes to knowledge about the health of the president? What kind of job do you think the White House has been doing so far when it comes to releasing information? What questions do you have about the kind of privacy a president is entitled to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Julie Rovner is Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of Kaiser's What the Health podcast. Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Do we have something like a standard operating procedure when it comes to a presidential health problem and what to tell the public about it?
Well, you know, we have rules and we have norms, and this president has basically blasted through whatever norms we've had for a lot of things, not just healthcare. Traditionally, the public has been kept apprised of at least most things about presidential health. Not everything. There's a long history of sometimes serious health issues being, you know, covered up. Franklin Roosevelt was in a wheelchair, which a lot of people didn't know because there was this sort of tacit agreement not to mention it among the press at the time. Woodrow Wilson spent the last 17 months of his presidency presumably unable, just barely able to function, which most people didn't know. So, you know, we've had examples of way worse things, but I will say that the last few presidents have been pretty open, and they've, you know, included Republicans and Democrats.
I've seen a lot of people over the last couple of days pointing toward HIPAA protections as an explanation for why we don't get the information about the president. Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, HIPAA was a law that was passed in 1996, but what we think of as the HIPAA medical privacy rules didn't take effect until 2000. So we've really only had them for the last three presidents, George W. Bush, President Obama, and now President Trump. And they basically say, and this is true for everybody, including the president, that you are entitled to keep your medical condition private. And anybody who holds that information, including a doctor or an insurer or somebody who does billing, is not permitted to allow any of that information out without the patient's express permission, which means that President Trump or any other patient can give those health professionals permission to tell people about their medical condition. And obviously, in this case, President Trump did not, or he said, you can tell them this, but not that. And that is within his legal rights under HIPAA. However, it might have been better if the doctor had said, you know, I've been asked not to discuss that, rather than sort of dance around the way he did.
What do you think we should know in a case like this about the president's state of health, Julie?
Well, obviously, the public wants to know that the president is physically capable of doing his job. I think that should be the bare minimum. And as I say, most recent presidents have basically hewed to that, including, you know, sort of things that, you know, when presidents have had colonoscopies and have been under sort of not quite full anesthesia, you know, they have transferred powers to the vice president for a few hours. I remember that happening several times. I mean, presidents have generally been extremely good about making sure that the public knows when they are not in complete control of their faculties. And with this president, you know, there have been so many things that he and his administration have told us that have turned out not to be so, that it's hard to know what to believe at this point.
As you look at what we've heard from the White House, doctors, spokespeople, and others over the last few days, do you see a lot of contradictions in the different messages we've gotten, maybe even within a few hours of each other?
Well, yeah, I mean, what we saw Saturday morning when the doctor came out and said everything is great. And then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows walked up to the pool reporters and tried to be off the record, except there were people with cameras and recorders running, and said, no, things are not great. We were really worried about him yesterday. So, I mean, that was sort of a microcosm of, you know, everything about this entire episode. We still don't know when the president was really first diagnosed, because they won't tell us when his last negative COVID test was. So we don't know how long he's actually had the disease. It means we don't know sort of where in the disease process he is. Is he really in the early few days, in which case it would be a few days from now you would expect problems to most likely crop up? Or has he had it for 8 to 10 days, in which case he really might be on the downside of it? There's just so much we haven't been told that it's hard to know. And, you know, I see frustration of doctors who are, you know, obviously don't want to, who have not examined the president, so they don't want to say, but who have dealt and taken care of a lot of other COVID patients, but don't have the basic information they would need to suggest, you know, what kind of shape the president might be in.
Talking to Julie Rovner from Kaiser Health News, looking at the president's COVID diagnosis and the information that has and hasn't been released from the White House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much do you think we in the public should know about the president's state of health, whether it's this president or any other? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Paula is with us in Madison. Paula, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My concern is that the misinformation we're getting now from the president, who keeps saying that this is, you know, COVID's not so bad, it's not that bad a disease, and kind of encouraging people not to wear masks and not you know, not stay out of groups. But he keeps failing to tell everyone about the resources that he has that we don't have. I mean, he was on all these medications, and even with good insurance, I wouldn't get those medications unless I was on a ventilator and, you know, death was rolling down the road. So I just want maybe a comment on that. It's very distressing to me.
Paula, thanks a lot for the call. Julie, the president's framing of the disease, especially given, as Paula says, the access to arguably some of the best healthcare on the planet right now.
Yeah, that's been very upsetting to a lot of public health experts who were hoping that this could, you know, be an object lesson for, yes, this is a very contagious disease, and there are some steps you can take. And by the way, the White House didn't take a lot of those steps that were recommended. And now we're seeing, you know, not just the president and the first lady, but, you know, a couple of dozen people who appear to have contracted COVID, most likely from each other. And also the fact that the president, yes, was given medications, including one completely experimental medication that it's very difficult to get, another that's still the subject of, you know, that's not quite FDA approved. So, of course, now he's going to say that he was cured, but we don't know by what, because he's gotten so many medications. He's kind of a clinical trial of one. As far as we know, those the medications he was getting have not been delivered together ever to any patient. So it's not really, he's not setting necessarily the best leadership example for what to do and what not to do with COVID. And certainly what a lot of people have been complaining about is that he's playing down the danger of this disease to the point where he's talking about going to the debate next week when he might well still be contagious.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. George is with us in Onalaska. George, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for letting me call in.
What do you think, George?
Well, our president is doing everything he should do. HIPAA law protects him. He's the only one that can authorize anybody to give any information. And quite honestly, it doesn't make any difference to the public. This all gets blown out of proportion.
George, thanks for the call. So George saying it's within the president's rights to control the information, and George is okay with how the president has handled it.
Well, it definitely is within the president's right to control the information. The question is does the president owe something to the public? And remember, he's not just president right now. He's candidate for re-election. So he's asking the public to you know, basically give him 4 more years. And do they deserve the right to know what is the status of his health? And as I say, that's not so much a law. It's been a norm, but it's been a norm that's been followed by pretty much every presidential candidate for the last several decades.
Thanks for calling in, George. We're talking to Julie Rovner right now, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of Kaiser's What the Health podcast. She's with us to talk about the current health of President Trump and how the White House has been communicating to the public about his illness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the messages we've gotten from the White House and the president's medical staff about the president's health? What do you think about what the public deserves to know? How much privacy do you think a sitting president in the United States is entitled to when it comes to their health? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about how the White House is communicating with the public about the health of the president since his COVID-19 diagnosis. Our guest is Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of Kaiser's What the Health podcast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what's been released to the public? Should the White House be more transparent, do you think, about the president's health? How much privacy should a sitting president have when it comes to their health? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on another caller now. Jack is with us in Marshfield. Jack, hi. Jack, are you there?
Yes, yeah. Can you
hear? Go ahead, Jack.
Yeah, I apologize. Hey, I just wanted to say something in the name of partisanship as far as we seem to be getting a lot of, I'm a long-term NPR fan and a fan of this show, but it's so one-sided, it's almost grotesque. I think it turns off a lot of customers because the president's certainly not touting that this is not a bad disease or that you know, it's not dangerous. It's definitely dangerous. I think early on it was just put in the context of flu because it just recently, in the last, let's say, couple months, have outdone annual flu for number of deaths. So it's not like it's dangerous, but it does affect a certain demographic and a certain group of people with comorbidities. And I've been in medicine the last 40 years of my life, so I'm pretty well versed in what's going on here. And just because of the way that he speaks of downplaying this a little bit does not mean that he does not believe it's a serious disease.
Jack, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. Julie, the president made the flu comparison again, I think just today or yesterday.
Yeah, he did. I talked about how 100,000 people die of seasonal flu. That's actually way more. I think that 1968 was the last time that 100,000 people died of the seasonal flu. That it's usually, and the president himself actually had this right back in the spring. It's more like, you know, 20 to 40 to in a really bad year, 60,000 people. And of course, now we have 200,000 Americans dead, more than that. So this is obviously more serious than the seasonal flu. And yeah, a lot of people are lucky and either get a mild case or have no symptoms at all, but it can hit anybody at any age. It's not just people with comorbidities. There are a lot of young people. There are a lot of people in their 20s and 30s who can either get sick and die, or we're now seeing stories about people who've gotten very sick and basically haven't gotten better. They're called the long haulers. So it's a serious disease. And actually, you know, science doesn't know all that much about it yet, which is part of the fear. It's not just the flu. It's not just a respiratory disease. It affects all of the organ systems. There are blood clotting issues. There are gastrointestinal issues. There are other circulatory issues. There are neurological issues. It is a very nasty virus.
Thanks a lot for calling in. We'll go to Diane now in Stoddard. Diane, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. The president has a pre-existing condition. Medically, how is he going to be handling this in the future? And how are the Republicans going to address this issue? Since we don't know what their health care plans have been for the last 30 or 40 years. Also, with having pre-existing conditions. You know, it's impacting kids that have asthma and diabetes and whatnot in elementary, junior, and high school. A lot of us haven't been tested. So since we haven't been tested, but we've had 2.5-3 week rendezvous with this disease and illness, I guess we wouldn't be considered pre-existing condition. So we're kind of fortunate.
Diane, I'm going to jump in. You gave us a lot to work with there. Let's get to this idea of pre-existing conditions. And Julie, I know a story you're watching closely is a Supreme Court case coming on the Affordable Care Act, which includes protections for coverage involving pre-existing conditions. People have been wondering if that goes away. Is COVID-19, having had it, given the mysteries you were just talking about, going to interfere with people's ability to get health coverage?
Yeah, I think clearly everybody who's had COVID will be determined to have had a pre-existing condition. And as I say, it's because we don't know what the long-term consequences are, even for people who don't show any symptoms, whether there, you know, are issues that did not manifest themselves when they first got it, but may come back later. And if the Affordable Care Act is struck down, which the Trump administration is in court asking for that to happen, then those protections would go away. And President Trump has said repeatedly that he supports those protections, but he's done nothing that can ensure that they remain or be put back. And in fact, he doesn't really have the power to do that himself. Congress would have to do that.
Right. The president had signed an executive something that said pre-existing conditions are covered. Did that have any force of law?
No, he signed an executive order that said it's the policy of the federal government that people with pre-existing conditions will be protected, but there's no enforcement mechanism. He doesn't have the power to do that. If the law was struck down, there would have to be new legislation passed. And Republicans have introduced some bills that say they would protect people with pre-existing conditions. But while they would require that insurers sell to them, they would not include all of the protections in the Affordable Care Act. In other words, that insurers sell to them at the same price or to necessarily cover all of those pre-existing conditions. There's a lot of additional protections that go in to really protecting people with pre-existing conditions.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Julie Rovner from Kaiser Health News about the president's COVID-19 diagnosis, information shared by the White House and the medical staff. Back to your calls now. Carolyn is with us in Sauk City. Carolyn, hi.
Hi. I was calling to ask, I had heard that the president might have been given dexamethasone, and it's so hard to know what's actually happening and what's not. I wanted to see if your guest knew about that, and if it's true, what the implications of that might be.
Julie?
Well, we were told that the president was given dexamethasone, which is a corticosteroid for inflammation. It's a common drug for many conditions. I have taken it. I had shingles and was given it some years ago. It can mess with your head. That's sort of the polite way to say it. I've seen a lot of people now reporting, you know, that when they were on steroids, that it made them manic. It can make you feel really great, but you don't stay on it for very long, and they actually taper you off of it, and coming down off of it can be extremely unpleasant. So we don't know whether he's still on it, what dose he was on, how, you know, when he will be or if he is being taken off of it. There's just an enormous amount that we don't know. But there were a lot of doctors who were very concerned about sort of some of the president's behavior, given the fact that he is reportedly on steroids.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Jim in Dubuque, Iowa. Jim, hi.
I have a question about the reliability of the test. The inventor of the PCR test, Dr. Kerry Mullis, won a Nobel Prize for inventing it, says it's not to be used for medical diagnosis. It's medical fraud. And on the CDC's website, if you look up what does a positive test mean, it says you might have antibodies to the virus that causes COVID-19 or another member of the coronavirus family, such as the one that causes the common cold.
Thanks for that call. Julie, I know there were some questions about the reliability of the testing that the White House had been using and also the wisdom of relying just on that testing.
Right. Well, I think the president's had a number of different tests. The White House has mostly been using a rapid test developed by Abbott, which is a whole different, which is not PCR test. The PCR test needs reagents, and it has to be done in a lab, and it takes some time. Those are the ones that, when there was such a big backlog, it was taking 10 days. They are the most accurate tests that we have. I mean, it's very difficult here, but one would think that with the number of different types of tests that he's had, that there seems to be little doubt. And obviously with the symptoms that we're told that he was showing, I don't think anybody doubts that this is what he has, assuming that we're being told, and assuming that the information that we're being told is correct.
Thanks a lot for that call. In our last couple of minutes, Julie, I just wanted to get your take on what you're watching for right now with COVID-19 and the response here in Wisconsin. We are seeing the most cases, and unfortunately now we're seeing hospitalizations and deaths creeping up here in the state. What do you have your eye on in the progress of this disease?
Yeah, you know, I think we're all watching to see what kind of a flu season that we get. You know, in some of the sort of in the winter for the Southern Hemisphere, we saw very low cases of flu because people were doing a good job wearing masks and social distancing. And that not only prevented COVID from spreading, it prevented the flu from spreading. But we're not doing as good a job in the United States at things like social distancing and wearing masks. And so, and, you know, it's hard to get people to get flu shots every year. I'm seeing anecdotal reports of spot shortages of flu vaccine. It's still pretty early, but I think a lot of people are getting their flu shots earlier than they normally would. I know I did. I usually wait till towards the end of October. So that's a big issue. And obviously just watching to see, you know, where cases are going up. They seem to be sort of creeping up slowly in a lot of places. And that's really a big concern.
Julie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of Kaiser's What the Health podcast. She joins us today to talk about the president's COVID-19 diagnosis and how the White House has released information about his health. You could still weigh in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Carol there, who says, I think we have the right to know of any physical condition that may affect a president's ability to do their job. Russ writes, the president has the same right to privacy that we all have. Tell us what you think again over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's head back to civics class a little bit. We may remember learning about the concept of federalism, balancing states' rights versus the authority of the federal government. Our next guest says that American federalism is flawed, doesn't work all that well, in fact. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think federalism is working in America? What do you think about the balance of power between state governments and the federal government? Do things need to be rebalanced? What kind of changes would you like to see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Don Kettle is the Sid Richardson Professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He focuses on public management and policy. Don also taught political science at UW-Madison back in the day. His latest book is called The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. Don, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it is so good to be with you and all my friends there in Wisconsin.
Good to have you back. Now, give us our operating definition of federalism, because we say the federal government, that means the national one. Federalism is this whole balancing act, right?
Exactly. I mean, federalism really has to do with how much power the federal government has, how much of that is given to the states, and then most importantly, what the balance between them ought to be. It's one of those things that we did learn back in civics class. Most of us have forgotten it since. Most of us think it's pretty boring, except when it turns out that it affects just about everything that we want government to do in figuring out just where power in the system lies.
Now, it doesn't sound sexy these days, but you write that when it was invented, largely by James Madison and his closest colleagues, it was trying to get over deal breakers to make us a country, right?
This was a really big deal, because if it were not for the invention of federalism, there simply would not be a country. At early stages, we managed against all odds to beat the British army and to drive them away. Then the question was, okay, what kind of country should we have? And we tried one system that really gave state governments a lot of power, but without giving a national government very much power. And that, the Articles of Confederation, did not work well at all. And so they had to go back for a kind of version 2.0 of American democracy. The founders met again in Philadelphia, wrote the Constitution. They thought, well, this is it. We've got this made. Except the state said, we're not going to ratify this unless you make clear how much power we're going to have, how much power state governments are going to have. And that created the beginning of the battle about the balance between the federal government and the states, which today we see in everything from COVID-19 to the Affordable Care Act to the question of environmental policy and what the speed limit ought to be.
You write that in many ways, federalism as it was created was doomed to at least some levels of failure. How quickly do we start to run into trouble?
Almost immediately. The idea was, okay, we'll draw a pretty clear line. We'll, as part of the Bill of Rights, create an amendment that says that the federal government has the powers that the federal government has, and all the rest of the powers go to the states. And that seemed a pretty clear line. But then almost immediately, we started having battles, not only, of course, over the question of slavery, which almost tore the country completely apart, but also on everything from education to highways to the question of the Postal Service. It's even the early days of the Postal Service led to the creation of postal roads that with post roads up in Connecticut, up in Rhode Island, there's still a road called the Post Road, which is a road back from those early days to make sure that the post office had a way to travel and to be able to convey the mail from one place to another. But especially on education, there was a debate early on, should the federal government have any role in education? And there doesn't seem to be anything about education itself in the Constitution. But when the federal government started carving up the land and the territories to create new states, there was a big press for trying to get more aid for education. And the federal government carved a piece out of every bit of land, for example, in Ohio. That was the first federal grant that was created. And then we were off to the races. And the question of trying to figure out where to draw that boundary line.
Talking to Don Kettle, political scientist, about his book, The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. Going to skip a bunch of history here, Don, that you flesh out in the book and get to what you see as one of the core problems in federalism and how we do it. Inequality amongst the states and for the people of the different states. Draw the line for us there.
Yeah, one of the things that's fascinating here is that you hear lots of stories about authors who have an argument that they sit down and they want to write about in a book. This is a case where I wasn't sure where I was going to end up, and I wrote the book in part to try to figure that out. And the deeper that I got into the book, the more clear it became that not only do we have big divisions between the individual states, between, say, Wisconsin and Minnesota and California and New York on the one hand, and then Mississippi and Alabama and Arkansas on the other, but those divisions are growing over time. If you want to understand the roots of inequality in America, and not just income inequality, but also in healthcare, environmental policy, in education, and just about anything you can imagine, it turns out that the fundamental roots of that problem really come from the role of the states, the decisions that states make, and the fact that those divisions over time are getting greater. And nowhere do we see a bigger piece of evidence of that than increasingly in healthcare, where that's the grand wedge that's really driving the states apart as much as anything.
You see a remedy for federalism as Madison crafted it, as a compromise in a kind of a popular figure these days, Alexander Hamilton. What would he have to tell us?
Well, Hamilton would, I think, be looking at this and say, you know, I told you, I warned you back there that we were going to get to this point and have this kind of problem. And what Hamilton would have said is that, look, allowing Madison's conception to rule is guaranteed to create a government at the center that's not strong enough to be able to make the decisions that we need to make. He would look at COVID-19 and say, this is precisely what I warned about. You really need to have a national government with the power to define what the problem is and to create a common way of being able to measure it, to develop a policy that can be pursued across the country, and that the consequences of allowing every state to go its own way means that we have some states that are doing pretty well right now, like New York, and other states that are not doing well at all, like North Dakota and South Dakota. And the differences largely have to do with different decisions made by different leaders and different places. And Hamilton, I think, would have looked at this and have been absolutely aghast at this and would have said, I predicted this, but he would have also said, there's a way out of this as well.
Now, you were here in Wisconsin at a time when the state took the lead on what we used to call welfare reform back in the day. And Governor Tommy Thompson and others talked about the state's role as a laboratory of democracy. and states being able to pioneer innovative ways to do things. Is there a way to retweak the federal-state balance without losing maybe those opportunities of innovation at the state level?
Yeah, it's one of the things that's really been terrific about federalism in so many ways, because Justice Louis Brandeis argued back in the 1920s that we really need to look at the states as laboratories of democracy. And Wisconsin was one of the grand laboratories in welfare reform, the grand reform that was passed, the one thing on which Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton were able to agree, in fact, was welfare reform. And that came out of experiments that happened in Wisconsin. That was a set of reforms from the Republican side. On the Democratic side, a lot of the efforts that we've been able to make to improve the quality of air, not only in California, but across the country, has come from improvements in air pollution regulations that California's put in place that then have been nationalized as well. And so if you look at this, we've had cases where states have in fact served as grand laboratories, have found ways of improving policy. The problem is increasingly we have laboratories where the states are breaking the test tubes and nobody's paying much attention to the results. The idea of a laboratory is that you experiment, find out what works, you do more of what's good and less of what's bad. What's happening increasingly instead is that we're just allowing states to go their own ways. And as states go their own ways, they're not learning these lessons and they're driving the states further apart, so that from air pollution to education to highways to jails to prisons, healthcare, environmental policy, just about anything you could imagine, the quality of government programs, then the differences between the states are getting larger and larger and larger. And those are the things, almost compared to anything else that we could imagine, that is responsible for polarization in the country and driving the results of public policy in different directions.
We're talking to Don Kettle, public management and policy expert, about his new book, The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with what our guest has to say about federalism not working, the balance between state and federal power not really getting it right? Do you think we need something different? How would we get there? If so, do you see in the current example of the COVID-19 pandemic, things working well or poorly when it comes to who's in charge of tackling this thing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the past, present, and future of federalism in these United States with Professor Don Kettle from the University of Texas, Austin. He's the author of The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. You can join in with your thoughts, reactions, and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Don, let's talk about now this current COVID-19 pandemic. Questions about who takes the lead on this national and international crisis. Is it the federal government? Do we leave it to states? How has this all played out through the lens of the work you've done in this book?
You know, one of the things that's fascinating about this is that there could simply not be a better example of the tensions within the system than what we see right now with COVID-19. The fact is, for the basics, that we don't have even a common language for talking about it. We don't have a simple common way of being able to measure the number of cases and the number of deaths across the country. We have different states going in different directions, changing their minds about how to measure this along the way. Even the data that we see on the evening news is largely the product not of the government, but of a special project at Johns Hopkins University, which has put this together. So how can we attack the problem unless we have a common way of talking about it, a common language? What should we do about it? And we don't have a clear sense of what the standards ought to be. We've had battles literally between the states about personal protective equipment and masks, and that's just been an unseemly kind of crisis in the middle of a health crisis that we've had to try to deal with. We've had differences of opinion about what the basic and most useful health steps ought to be with the Centers for Disease Control and the individual states going in different kinds of directions. The problem is that it'd be one thing if we wanted to allow states to experiment in different ways, for example, of teaching kindergartners. But as long as we're in a position where a disease is just one airplane flight away, one state from another, or one stop at a restroom along an interstate highway away from another. We have a set of circumstances where we have an obligation, I think, to have a national strategy to try to deal with clearly is a national problem. And that is one of the ways in which, sadly, the system that we call federalism is really left us short in the middle of this enormous crisis.
Let's bring on a caller. Jody is with us in Monona. Jody, hi.
I might be juggling some of what he just said, but I think you can see the problem when the federal government, when COVID came out, told all the states to take care of it. The states went and ordered medical supplies and PPE, and then the federal government stepped in and redirected the supplies that states were getting. So they either stay in or stay out, and really we need a national plan.
Jody, thanks for the call. But Don, maybe this was an administration problem, not a fundamental systemic problem. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's one way to suggest it. But at the very core, the central problem really is as central to a constitutional problem as we could imagine, that by allowing the states to go in different directions, by the federal government refusing to stand up and lead and then suggesting that each state needs to go in its own direction, I mean, how could we possibly imagine that we could have a set of circumstances where we'd have the federal government bidding against state governments for the same pieces of equipment? And governors complained about that at the beginning stages. The fact is, if you look at the spread of the disease in the United States compared to any other system with also a federal system, we rank just about the worst in the world. And the rate of deaths and the spread of the virus in the United States really ranks among, again, the worst in the world. And so for a system that really prides itself on providing power to citizens and giving an opportunity for experimentation, that kind of poor performance is just simply unacceptable. And it's not a place where we needed to go. And at some point, we have to ask ourselves whether or not this is really the product of a basic set of issues and problems that are hardwired into the Constitution. We can change some of this by reforms, by having a clear sense about who it is that needs to do what, but allowing ourselves to continue down this road is going to lead to further problems, not only in dealing with COVID, but also in a whole set of other things we care about, where we're going to be driving a greater wedge of inequality through the country in ways that are only going to undermine the trust that we have and the ability of our government to do what it is we want government to do.
In our last minute and a half or so, Don, what would it take to get from here, where we are now, to there, this, I guess, Hamiltonian-inspired fix to our current federal system?
I think if Hamilton came back, he would say there are some things that the federal government needs to do, the things that clearly have to do with a central driving national policy or things that the federal government needs to have a stronger voice in, things that have to do with evening out the differences and the things we care most about, especially having to do with inequality in the country, the federal government needs to take a stronger role in. So maybe when it comes to building roads and bridges, the federal government steps back and allows local communities to take more of a role in that. But on the basics, especially having to do with things like healthcare, the environment, and other things that really strike across the country, those are places where I think Hamilton would say the federal government needs to take a stronger role.
And briefly, I mean, this concept of the rights of states to manage more of this stuff, is this sacred text burnt in to America, or was it just a compromise that we should be willing to change?
It was a compromise from the very, very beginning. We have this kind of reverential notion that from the very beginning that somehow we had this exalted sense of things engraved in stone tablets. But in fact, it was a matter of political compromise from the beginning. And that political compromise is something we can revisit. And as I argue in the book, The Divided States of America, is something we think we have to revisit at this point.
Don, thanks again for joining us today.
So good to be with you, Rob.
Don Kettle is the Sid Richardson Professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He previously taught political science at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about his latest book. It's called The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. In a year of COVID-19, social unrest, and widespread unemployment, the Affordable Care Act didn't start off as a major campaign issue in the presidential race, but it suddenly became one following the death of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. As Shemaine Mills reports, the Republican push to replace Ginsburg has refocused attention on a court case that could scrap the Affordable Care Act.
The U.S. Supreme Court has twice upheld what's commonly referred to as Obamacare, but now the composition of the court has changed. There's one less supporter of the ACA on the high court with Justice Ginsburg gone, and President Trump has nominated Judge Amy Coney Barrett to replace her. Suddenly, Democrats, including former Vice President Joe Biden, have been shifting their focus to the court and the signature health care law they helped pass.
This is about your health care. This is about whether or not the ACA will exist. This is about whether or not pre-existing conditions will be continue to be covered.
The fate of the ACA will be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case scheduled for arguments just 1 week after the election. Trump ran in 2016 on a promise to get rid of the ACA. 4 years later, he's still saying that.
We're going to replace Obamacare with great health care at a lesser price.
Lawyers for the Trump administration have called on the Supreme Court to repeal the entire ACA. They argue that because Congress eliminated the penalty for not having insurance, the law is no longer valid and the whole thing should go. The health care fight is a familiar one, but circumstances are different than they were 4 years ago. Polling shows the law is more popular now. Part of the reason Obamacare initially struggled to gain public support is because people are generally happy with the insurance they have through their jobs. But those who are self-employed either have to go without insurance or buy their own. For the last 2 years, Ron Robleski has purchased a policy through the Affordable Care Act marketplace.
I wanted to have health care. I wanted to have health insurance. I value being healthy. I want to stay walking this earth for as long as I can physically manage.
The 60-year-old Madison mechanical engineer is generally in good health. He's trim and likes to hike, bike, and ski when he's not running his company, Productive Energy Solutions. 2 years ago, he was hospitalized for intestinal bleeding.
I was lucky, and they were able to find the spot where it was bleeding and clamp it off. And it was, a successful intervention.
Robleski says if he hadn't had insurance, he probably would have delayed going to the doctor.
So it's just absolutely mind-boggling to me that in the midst of all that, people are still talking about gutting the ACA and kicking more people off of their health insurance.
The global pandemic has also placed healthcare in a different light this year. Hundreds of thousands have died in the U.S. and millions have lost their jobs. Karen Politz is with the Kaiser Family Foundation.
It just provides a new lens for thinking about all these things. So, you know, insurance covering preventive services, including vaccines, very popular when you think about insurance covering a coronavirus vaccine. You know, that just sort of makes it, I think, real for people in a different way.
Beyond that, there are other elements of the ACA that affect nearly everyone. For example, it lets children stay on their parents' insurance until they turn 26. And it also got rid of a donut hole in Medicare prescription drug coverage. And it eliminated annual and lifetime limits on health coverage.
And if that were all overturned, people would notice.
Trump and Biden are still talking about other topics, from one another's temperament to police to the economy. But the pandemic, along with the death of Justice Ginsburg, has once again put a focus on the Affordable Care Act, a law that has divided the country for more than a decade. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, Kate checks in with the Wisconsin Hospital Association to find out how hospitals around the state are coping with Wisconsin's surge in COVID-19 positive cases and hospitalizations. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show.